Welcome to episode 161 of Practical Defense, an interview with Graciela Casillas-Tortorelli, a joint production of the Practical Defense Podcast and the Pro Arms Broadcast. Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I am your host, Alex Haddix. We have a fantastic and a rather long show for you this week. We sit down with Graciela Casillas-Tortorelli, and most people know her just as Graciela Casillas. Now, Graciela is a pioneer in women's martial arts and a former world champion in both women's boxing and kickboxing. She retired undefeated with a record of 31-0 with 18 knockouts. She not only shares her experiences coming up in the early years of martial arts in the United States as a woman, but she also recounts her experience when she was attacked on a lonely stretch of highway when her car broke down. This show is also our first joint podcast. It's a collaboration with Gail Pepin of the Pro Arms Podcast, a fellow member of the Gun Rights Radio Network. Gail and I interviewed Graciela together, and you'll also be able to hear the interview on the Pro Arms Broadcast. Graciela attended the MAG 20 seminar with Masad Ayoub back on January 29th and 30th. We conducted the interview with our travel equipment in a hotel room, so please excuse any sound issues. And speaking of the MAG 20 event, it was just amazing. Mass is an incredible lecturer, and his material is unparalleled. The days were long, but worth every second. If you ever have an opportunity to learn from Mass, take it. He lectures and teaches all over the country, so check out his website and make an effort to study under him when he's in a town near you. The subject matter applies to you whether you use firearms or just your empty hands. It was also great to meet some podcast listeners and members of the Gun Rights Radio forums. I can finally put some faces and voices to the names I see on the board and receive in emails. It was awesome to finally meet some of you, and I hope more will come out to future seminars. So with great appreciation to both Gail and Graciela, we turn to our joint Practical Defense and Pro Arms Broadcast interview of Graciela Casillas-Tortorelli.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
It was one of the worst mass murders committed by a single person. It happened down south. A lunatic killed 27 people, including his own mother, in a single pass. The killer used a six-shot revolver and a knife. Mass murderers find whatever tools they need, and those tools don't need to be sporting rifles or high-capacity clips. A slow, reloading revolver is all this fellow needed. Banning clips will not prevent a madman's massacre, but that doesn't matter to the gun control industry, who thinks inanimate objects are evil, but ignore the deranged people who misuse them. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
Welcome, everyone, to the first joint Practical Defense Podcast in the Pro Arms Broadcast. Today, our hosts are me, Alex Haddix, and Gail Pepin.
Hi, Alex.
Hey, this is going to be great.
This is. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks. I've got my high heels on today.
And they look fabulous.
Our amazing guest this week is Graciela Casillas-Tortorelli. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice being here.
So let's start by going over your background. I'm going to let you explain that because it is amazing and varied and spans over three decades.
Well, I'll try to be brief. However, I've been in the martial arts for approximately 37 years. I started as a way of getting out of my house when I was 15 years old. I wanted to go and hang out with other kids, and I was allowed to go to church. And at this church, a priest asked if we could take a self-defense class. So he brought a Taekwondo instructor, and I started taking classes there along with three or four of my brothers. And eventually they lost interest, and I continued. And after that class ended, I ended up joining another local martial arts school. And as I started going up the ranks, one of the things that I noticed was that I never got to test what I was learning, meaning that in those days, this is in the early 70s, people were competing and we weren't allowed to. So as I continued to learn more about martial arts, I was already thinking that I wanted to teach one day, and I felt that how can I teach if I have no idea whether what I'm really made out of, whether I would buckle under pressure or whether I could apply what I was learning. So I started competing in what was called full contact karate at the time. It was like professional kickboxing.
Why did you go directly to professional? Why didn't you do the amateurs? I mean, I started, you know, the amateur tournaments, the local tournaments, the international, Ed Parker's Internationals. Why didn't you skip all that and go right to pro?
Well, these were not the tournament. This was full contact to the knockout. And the reason I did that was because, one, I didn't know the difference. I was in a small town. I was in Oxnard, and all we knew about was that there was full contact karate. And in full contact karate, or known as kickboxing, there was amateur. After fighting about three times amateur and getting beat up and going, I'm doing this just for a piece of plastic, and other people were turning pro, myself along with a few other local fighters said, let's go pro. There's no big difference, except we might make $100 a round. So that was the reason I decided for the money. Might as well, if I'm going to get hit, might as well get paid for it.
Sounds logical to me.
So I started actually.
But not for $100.
Well,
it was the 70s.
The 70s, $100 a round. If you think about it, you had a 10-round fight, more in the boxing, that was $1,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't understand. It was $100 a round.
A round,
okay.
Yes.
That was $100 purse.
No. But actually, if I think about it, I was kickboxing first as an amateur, but as a professional, I became a professional boxer before I became a professional kickboxer, because there wasn't a lot of action for women. There was so few women competing in the 70s. And I had heard about a lady who I got to meet and train with named Lily Rodriguez. May she rest in peace. And she was a kickboxer, and she was also boxing. And at that time, I figured, well, boxing, all I have to do is keep my feet on the ground. And so it gave me more activity where I could maybe kickbox 1 month. A few months later, I could box. And what I learned was that I just really enjoyed the training and the excitement of you know, getting ready for a fight. So I started boxing, and it was kind of a fluke thing. And July 13th, Friday the 13th, 1979, I became world champion in boxing by accident.
By accident?
I say by accident because I was supposed to be a tune-up match for the world champion at the LA Sports Arena. It was a very special event because it was the first all-women's card that had been hosted at the Los Angeles Sports Arena. And her opponent injured herself, so they were quickly looking for a replacement. I'd never boxed professionally. So after they kind of doctored up my record and got me approved, I was able to fight that night. And I have to say, the world champion retired. Not to sound arrogant, but she retired that night, and I went in her place 2 weeks later to San Antonio, Texas, and defended the title in a 10-3-minute round fight, which went the distance. And that's how I became boxing world champion. And it wasn't until 2 years later that I actually fought for a world title in kickboxing.
How was that transition? Because growing up as a martial artist, whenever I tried boxing, I kept picking my leg up and wanting to kick, and I had such a hard time keeping my feet on the ground whenever I was sparring and trying to box with friends.
I never had that problem. I guess it just depends, because you might have had that problem because you were competing in tournaments. I never competed in tournaments. I had one fight that I would train for, no different than professional kickboxing or boxing today. The only time I was at Ed Parker's Internationals was to do a demonstration when I had an all-women's demo team. But I never competed in that circuit.
Okay.
I don't seem to recall there being a lot of women's boxing in the 70s.
There was not a lot of women's boxing in the 70s. In fact, there was few women boxing, and also we were, I don't want to say treat it so badly, but the love of fighting pushed us to put up with a lot. When I first started fighting, there were no weight divisions for women. We basically had very few rights. So, I mean, we were licensed. However, we couldn't ask for anything. I was considered a difficult boxer to work with because I was demanding getting paid $100 a round. And I had a trainer when I became serious about boxing, and I thought I was, I went from Oxnard, Ventura County, I transferred to the University of UCSB, and I continued training on my own. As women boxers, we didn't have access to really good trainers because we weren't taken serious, number one, and there was just so few of us. There was, I mean, if we found other women to train with, most likely we would end up fighting that female. So you only trained with men. So when I became serious about it, I came from Los Angeles to the Olympic Boxing Gym, which no longer exists. You're probably aware of it. I started training there. And I was the only female in a boxing gym where there was 36 to 40 male fighters. So we put up with a lot of crap because it was, if you don't want to fight, well, hey, we don't need you. But yet we were exploited. We were used. We were paid very little. We weren't given contracts. We weren't given training money. And this is being a world champion. However, if you looked at the posters, it was my picture on there, or I was a main event. But I wasn't getting paid anything. But if you complain, they say, hey, no problem, go away.
So the males would get paid.
Oh, the men did get paid. You could never, and I understood that women have not been boxing as long as men, so I didn't expect to get paid equal to a male world champion. However, it wasn't equitable, and it's still not equitable to this day. So I spoke to Lucia Riker, who, if you watch Million Dollar Baby, she played the villain in that film. And when I spoke to her a couple years ago, I was asking her about that because she's remained in the field, and she said, Graciela, it hasn't changed much unless you're Christy Martin or you have the last name of Ali or, you know, some big name. You're still not getting paid.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Absolutely. What about the Chuck Norris's World Combat League?
You're seeing more women. I follow that, not real closely, but that's a mixed martial, more mixed martial arts, kickboxing. You're seeing more women. But I think they have a couple women now. And they are getting paid better than I guess, professional boxers. But once again, if you talk to male promoters, for example, I, towards the end of my career, I retired in 1986. And ironically, my very first fight was in Los Angeles at the LA Sports Arena. My last fight, 1986, was in Los Angeles at the Forum. And in between that, I had 31 professional fights, a combined record. I never lost, and I had 18 knockouts. I was never able to fight in California because California would not sanction a 10-round fight, which is what was required to defend your title at the time.
Well, go ahead. I was going to say, what was the reason for that?
Many states would not license women to fight. For example, Arizona would not sanction women to fight, would not license women to fight. I wanted Bill Packer, promoter in Arizona, for example, wanted to bring me out to fight. They would not license, the state of Arizona would not license women. And it's ironic because women actually have superior endurance than men do. But yet we weren't allowed to fight 10 rounds where the men were fighting more rounds. Once I had a write-up in Us Magazine, the following month I was brought in as a main event. So it makes you wonder, you know, what the motivation is. They're concerned as to whether or not they were going to draw, you know, pull the money in or not, I guess. But many states, California wouldn't. I was the first woman to fight in Arizona. I was the first woman to fight in Dominican Republic. Most of my fights ended up going elsewhere, with the exception of Nevada. And what I was going to say earlier is, as females, we were exploited. Yet, I fought, all my last fights were with Bob Arum, who's a very big promoter, and I fought on his undercard, but when he came to Los Angeles and there was a fight here where Pepino was fighting Cuevas, and ESPN wanted to introduce me, he would not allow them to introduce me on camera. And being young and kind of, I'm going to go ask him what the problem is. I went up to him and I asked, I said, they want to introduce me. What's the problem? Is it because I'm a woman? He said, absolutely. That's all he had to say to me. And that was then. And of course, years later, his attitude changed. And he also, you know, I guess had women on contract. But in the 70s, it was just late 70s. You just didn't hear much about it.
Now, you also mentioned that the gyms where you were training at, you would be the only woman.
I was the only woman trained at the Olympic boxing gym. Jimmy Montoya, who was my trainer at the time, had probably one of the largest stables in California. And he provided a lot of fighters for some of the bigger promoters. And as much as I felt he looked out for me, he would always say, well, the promoters are doing me a favor. You know, they don't want women on their shows. And so that's the way it was. And if you wanted to fight, I wanted to fight. We didn't have much say. Either you took the fight or you didn't. I fought in Hong Kong. I had to give up 30 pounds. And many fights that I had, there were no weight divisions until much later.
So how were you treated by the men in the gyms? Were you accepted there?
Not at first. Especially you're talking about a gym where it's all Latino. Mm-hmm. Majority of them don't speak English. And me being Latin background, number one, they didn't understand why I was there. Number two, they offered to take care of me so I wouldn't have to fight. but I had to
That's
just
sweet.
I had to really keep the mindset that I was there, sort of have tunnel vision that I was there to train. I couldn't socialize. I couldn't really interact with them much because they'd get mixed messages. It took about 3 months before they started accepting me as a serious fighter, because you have to understand that also during that era, female athletes in that type of unconventional sport was also seen sort of as a freak show. Mm-hmm. You know, two women fighting, it just wasn't acceptable. And after months, I started developing more support there, where I got to train with some of the top fighters in the world. For my last fight, Hector Camacho Sr. was one of my training partners. In fact, in Florida, I did a boxing uh-huh. exhibition with him.
Wow.
And the state of Florida would not give me
they
a license.
Wouldn't.
So until he said, either you license her or I'm not going to do whatever my exhibition. And so they gave me a license.
Wow.
And this was in 1986. Long time ago.
No, some of us still remember 1986 quite well, so it's not that long ago.
I don't want to dominate the conversation, but I had one more question. We were talking a little bit earlier about when you were training, how you kind of in the gym, how you know, the men did 10 push-ups, you would have to do 20 push-ups just to be accepted.
Well, as I said earlier, I've been in the martial arts exactly 37 years, and when I first started in the martial arts, I oftentimes would look around and wherever I was, whatever school I was, and maybe there was two or three women. There was never a lot of women in the schools. And as the years went by, I thought I just assumed that would change. And now as an instructor for many, many years, I still see that there's an inequality in numbers. And I think part of it is that you have to be pretty thick-skinned to survive in the schools because... And not to offend the martial arts world, but I think the martial arts also attracts a lot of men. Let me see, how can I say this? They lack confidence or small men's complexes or, you know.
It, kind of thing.
Well there are those type of martial arts instructors that want people, the students to bow down. They like the idea of I am grandmaster. I, for example, have the title of grandmaster, but I don't use it because I don't see myself that way. The titles aren't important to me, but there are people that do. So when women come into a school and they're treated a certain way, they're discouraged from coming back. They don't feel they can actually excel in whatever the art is that they're training in. And when I started training the martial arts, I had a good experience in the beginning. However, when I moved to Los Angeles and joined other schools where I was the only female or we were the minority, I noticed that I wasn't taken seriously, and I felt like in order for me to be taken seriously, it was to be respected. The word is respect. To be respected in terms of you're here to learn also, that whatever the men were doing, I had to do it better just to be seen as an equal, because they don't expect you as a woman to be good. In one particular school that I started in 1980, not mentioning any names, when I first started this school, everybody loved me because I was this world champion and I was nice. But as I started training, they went, oh, she can do this stuff too. Can I say
You can say
Sorry.
On my show, you can say
sorry.
I'll believe it for mine.
Okay. Oh, shoot. She can do it, too. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't so popular. Then they started seeing me more as a threat. And why, I don't know, because I wasn't trying to compete with them. And as women, I think that's important. At least for me, it was important to make the statement that I'm not trying to compete with men. I'm not trying to say, I am woman, hear me roar. You know, that was Helen Reddy, who I used to train also. I wasn't trying to prove that I was better than men because we're different. But some men might have taken it that way, that I was trying to compete with them. And I have to say that if it weren't for the men that I did that did accept me and help me, I would never have been as good as I was, because unfortunately women, when I was fighting, didn't have access to really good trainers. So the fact that I did have access to world-class fighters that were rated in the top 10 in the world, I believe that's what made me a good fighter. So I appreciated having men to train with. And I tell women as an instructor today, I still tell them, if you can train with men, don't train with women.
Why is that?
Because I think it's really important that they train with men, because nine times out of 10, they're going to be attacked if they're attacked by a male, not another female. And the energy is different. Take, for example, at Oxnard College, I teach jiu-jitsu classes. You would think, and it's important, jiu-jitsu is a great art for self-defense for women. Do I get the women in there? After teaching there for 11 years, I'm starting to see more women. Everybody wants to, we want to grapple, mixed martial arts, great, we want to go to the mat. When you call their bluff and say, okay, we're going to do mat work today, nobody wants to do it. Some of the guys do, because they're thinking mixed martial arts, they want to compete. But from a street perspective, women are not comfortable being up that close and personal, feeling somebody's body rub against yours. And I have to tell them, listen, you're here in a safe environment. This is the place you should allow it to happen, where you're being monitored, where you feel good. Because in the street, or if you wake up, the analogy I use, if you wake up in the middle of the night and someone's on top of you that you didn't invite, now what are you going to do?
I agree completely, but I also want to say that as a man, it's also difficult sometimes, especially when you've never done any sort of martial arts training before, you're not used to that closeness, to get in the jiu-jitsu positions and roll around on the floor with another man that usually is reserved for your spouse. It can be very uncomfortable, and it's probably only more so for a woman. But even men experience that problem.
Oh, that's interesting. I sort of become more aware of that in the last couple of years, where I've noticed the men are reluctant. The few that have come back from a wrestling background from high school, they're okay with it. And you always have to preface it with, basically telling them, embrace the opportunity that you're being given right now, because you're not going to maybe get a second chance if this happens to you in the street.
I came from a stand-up background, 20-plus years stand-up, and mm-hmm. only a couple of years ago started doing groundwork. And mm-hmm. I thought I had eliminated that spatial barrier, that, uncomfortably being very, very close, because we do takedowns if we get very close. But it's on the ground, feeling the body weight's different than feeling the body weight rubbing up against when you're standing. And it's a very different feel.
Very different.
And it even for me, with all my experience, it took a little bit of adjustment. It was like a couple of clicks in the brain. All right. But even then, it's different. So a woman, I'm certain, is much different, much worse.
Very uncomfortable. And that's why I'm a firm believer. I mean, in the last few years, for those people that are involved in martial arts, and even the non-martial artists, if you were to do a survey, you'd be surprised how many non-martial artists love watching mixed martial arts. Started with UFC, and now, there's so many different organizations, and you don't have to be a martial artist to be a fan of that. People are watching it. And unfortunately, I think it's also creating a mentality that's not real. And especially, not just for women. The mentality is, we need to become good grapplers, and everybody needs to become a Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And I have, my own thoughts on that. However, when it comes to the mixed martial arts and grappling, yes, it's true, and you hear it said over and over, that every confrontation most likely is going to end up on the ground. But what they're not telling students is that that's the last place in the world you want to be. You do not want to be on your back. You do not want to be on your back, because the minute the minute you end up on your back, and assuming it's one against one, but most of the time it may not be, when you get kicked in the spine or get kicked in the head because you didn't see the other person coming, you try to apply a jujikatami or whatever, you know, from that position. So a lot of, unfortunately, and this goes back to the training at different martial arts schools where they're not making that distinction and saying, hey, this is fantastic if you want to go into the sport, but understand this is not for the street. Some of the skill is translatable. However, not all of it is. And I feel as an instructor, it's my responsibility to make sure if someone comes to me as a student that the first thing I do in my college classes, I say, okay, you guys who want to be grapplers, go down the street. There's a school if you want to go into the sporting. We are not focusing on the sporting aspect. I'm not going to mislead you and tell you that this is for the sport. The skills is an armbar, whether you're Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which I'm still confused about that because as far as I know my history, jiu-jitsu originated in Japan. And sometimes I think an armbar, whether you learned it in Japan or in Brazil, is still an armbar. Now, I happen to be Mexican-American background. I teach jiu-jitsu, so guess what? You come to learn from me, you learn Mexican jiu-jitsu. I mean, what is this? I mean, I have total respect for the Gracies, but, you know, students now are becoming confused where, no, I don't, I ask them, oh, no, I don't study jiu-jitsu. I study Brazilian jiu-jitsu, but
there are differences in the application.
Application, and yes, I understand that, but it still came from one source.
We can, yeah, absolutely. But, and we can make the argument that all martial arts came from, you know, the Shaolin Temple, and therefore there's only one art, and this is all different flavors. It's a long, complex discussion. But when you're talking about self-defense in the street, let's move on to your personal experiences with that. Now, you have personal experience with being attacked by a man. Can you set us up and let us know how that started?
Years ago, I was driving down Pacific Coast Highway. I live in Oxnard. Well, actually, I lived in Santa Monica at the time. I'd go back and forth to Oxnard. And as you know, sometimes when it rains, you know, you have the mudslides and the roads are not good. So my vehicle broke down. I think my alternator went out. And I was trying to get back to Santa Monica. And it's very dark. And as you know, there's not, I've gone up and down that highway so many times, I'm pretty much familiar where there's a little cantina and then further up there's a gas station. But now, I pulled over.
So I can explain to everybody who's not familiar with PCH, which is most of the world.
Oh.
Just Pacific Coast Highway. Mm-hmm. And on one side you have the ocean. On the other side you have cliffs that are 100 feet high. There are no roads that come in except that, you know, probably 4 or 5 mile markers. And you may have houses high on the cliffs. Sometimes you have houses on the ocean side, but sometimes
there was nothing.
Just a barren stretch of land for miles in either direction. So if you get stranded out there, you are alone.
And that's what happened to me. I pulled over, and this is sort of pre-cell phones. That's when the brick was out. Dating myself.
Oh, wow.
This was like, I think, 83. I mean, some people.
Like several thousand dollars.
Well, I didn't have one. So I sat there for a little bit. I've already, you know, been a martial artist for years, and I thought about, okay, what to do. I knew that there was a gas station further up, so I thought I'm going to just walk. And I immediately, as soon as I got out, I realized there's no lights there. It's kind of scary. And at that moment, I really wasn't, all I was thinking of is I hope some vehicle doesn't swerve over and hit me more, because it was such a narrow dirt area, and it's one of those places where there is just the drop that you're familiar with. So as I'm walking, a vehicle comes up, passes me and stops abruptly further up. And I'm thinking, okay, right away I wasn't sure, okay, is this maybe somebody that just thinks I need help? Because obviously my car is there and I'm walking. And as I approach the car, I'm looking around, I'm thinking, okay, I have nowhere to go. There's a drop there, but I walk as far away from the street as I can. This one person individual gets out of the car. He's kind of a little scruffy looking, big army green jacket, sort of long hair, and is real nice. And says, how are you doing? Hey, we're going to a party up here by the university. Do you want to go with us? And I'm like, oh, no, my friends are waiting right up ahead for me. And
so there was how many of them?
There was two. There was two.
So the driver and the passenger, and the passenger is the one that got out.
Right. And
the university would be Pepperdine.
Pepperdine University, yes. And I'm going, oh, no, my friends are waiting for me. And I'm sure they saw the vehicle and knew, you know, wasn't accurate. But And so we made a little small talk. I don't remember all the specifics, but as I was walking past him, he just switched. It was freaky. It was like, I can't say what he said, but you're going with us. As I can, but for you, I can't. He says, you're going with me.
Is that with the
B? Yes.
Okay.
Okay, you're going with us. And he grabbed my hair and started pulling me in. And as he grabbed me, and right at the moment, first, the one thing that I will never forget is a smell. You know how you don't forget smells if you go to a foreign country. The smells are different. But it was a strong chemical smell. And not being an expert on drugs, they were high, obviously high on something.
So it wasn't a liquor smell?
No, it was not a liquor smell. It was some other, it smelled like fumes or something. And as he grabbed my hair and started pulling me in towards him, all I saw was a glint of like a blade coming this way at me, at my throat.
A knife.
Mm-hmm. And what I did was the most basic movement that I probably have executed thousands of times that I to this day I teach, which I just parry, lift, and grabbed onto the hand as hard as I could.
The hand that was holding the blade?
Yes, because it was coming this way at me, like this. And
the arm motions are above her head, above her shoulder level, both hands grabbing and pulling.
And everything happened so fast. It was so strange. I just felt like I can't even explain it, but what happened is as he tried to grab me, I went flying. I fell forward into him. And I would like to say that it was very calculated, but I just slammed, as my head came in, I smashed his head right about here with my head.
Top of the nose.
And this is embarrassing to say, but if you notice here, to this day, I have a bump here, because as much as I teach when you headbutt, this is my, I have a little kind of like a Van Damme knot on the head. It's been there since that day. It's never gone away because I didn't quite catch him with my hairline. Accuracy, form goes out the window. And at that point, we both fell. I just heard a sound. I didn't know whether his blade was this way, whether it ended up in his body. I can't know 100% sure that I stabbed him, but all I know is that I heard like a gurgling sound. At that point, I felt like a rocket was strapped to me. I jumped back because all I could think of was get away from here. I started moving back, and I saw his friend coming out of the car, and I thought he was coming after me. And as I ran, I looked back, and he was just going to pick up the other guy. And it was a very strange feeling. I could taste it. It's a strange feeling. Felt like my heart was coming out of my chest. I could almost it felt like I had blood in my throat. It was just such a weird feeling. But I managed to get to the gas station. I should have called the police first. I called them second. I called my friend Cliff Stewart because he's an executive protection specialist, and I was, I could barely talk. And I sat there at the gas station. And I just felt like I was numb until he got there. And
you got there before the police did?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So just to summarize, if I can. For the defensive move that you used, as you saw the blade, you grabbed the arm and the whole arm, and then you lost balance and fell into him. And as you fell into him, you gave him a headbutt, and then you both fell down. And you both fell down, but fortunately the knife was away from you and towards him and fell into him.
See this move here. It's this. It's a parried lift. So it was this hand came up. That's all I had left. I got nicked there. This cut here.
She showed me your forearm.
Yeah, I got cut there. I went here and then grabbed on. Wasn't real deep. I didn't even notice it till later. And from here, just moving here and then going forward.
Okay. So it was like a parry into a block and then a grab.
But the one thing I was always taught from early on is when it comes to a blade, and at that split second, I wasn't even sure what it was. I was always taught to control the weapon hand, not to even whatever's in his hand, and that's what I was just terrified. I just held on to the hand or to the wrist,
and the knife ended up in him somehow.
He didn't get up. I don't. And we called all the Cliff researched the hospitals, and nobody went in. What they did was they did a U-turn and took off towards Oxnard.
And you continued north.
Mm-hmm.
On
towards Malibu. Yes. No. They went north. I went south.
Okay.
So you never found out what happened to him.
Mm-mm.
And what's also interesting is that based on some of the emails that I've received from law enforcement to the show, it's common for people to call friends before they call the police in times of stress. When they have a chance, they call somebody they trust before they call the police. And that was also a natural reaction.
He was my friend and training partner, and I have a lot of respect for him because I've learned a lot. He's like one of my teachers, so yes, it was like a comforting to call him.
But how did you cope with the aftermath?
And this is kind of embarrassing now that I'm older and I know more, but at that time, my friend Cliff said, "Girlfriend, are you crazy?" Because I said, "I wonder if he's okay."
You were worried about him.
It was so strange that afterwards I second-guessed myself and I was thinking, oh, my God, what happened to him? And my friend looked at me and said, like, are you crazy? This guy, you don't know where you would. If you would have been someone else that had no training nor no instinctive reaction, who knows where you would be right now. But it was that little feeling of almost guilt, because I thought, well, if I wouldn't have been there, if my car wouldn't have broken down, I wouldn't have. I put myself in that situation, in other words. And since then, I've learned always that having good maintenance for your vehicle, it turned out to be my alternator, is part of self defense. It's very important.
Things can happen at any time,
right?
Cars are better now. In the 70s, cars broke down a whole lot more than they do now. But things like that can just happen any time.
But when you're going through it after the fact, you start thinking of the whole scenario and say, well, if I would have done this, I could have done that, I should have done this. But I was younger.
You didn't do anything wrong.
True.
Yeah, you should have been able to walk down that road without fear.
That is true, but that's not the world we live in. No different that's than a woman true. Should be able to walk into a bar scantily dressed without being harassed, but we know that's not reality. So it's a question of the choices we make.
Well, we teach people not to put themselves in those situations, not to go places that are not safe. But in your case, you had no choice.
It's funny because all these years when I meet people and they know what I did as a professional fighter, the most common reaction I get from men would be, oh, I'd hate to run into you in a dark alley. And I think, I look at them, I think, well, I don't hang out in dark alleys. Who hangs out in dark alleys? Of course.
People looking for trouble hang out in dark alleys. Not people trying to avoid trouble. Now, because of what happened here, did that lead you to design the knife you designed for Masters of Defense?
That had a lot to do with it.
Talk about that knife a little bit.
I designed a blade for women. I was actually approached by a group along with Mass to design, and if this is correct, if my memory's correct, I believe it was one of the first times that a company approached trainers to design a blade that it was specifically for self-defense. Prior to that, it's my understanding that majority of knives were, they're called utility blades. And this, the idea was for self-defense, and I wanted to design a blade that was small enough but effective enough where my goal behind is the way I designed it, which was small enough that a woman with a small hand would be able to retain the weapon, because weapon retention is critical. If you can't retain any kind of weapon, then you risk the chance that it will be taken away from you and used against you. And over all the years that I have been involved in training and doing self-defense seminars, everywhere you go, you hear this, well, women shouldn't use, you shouldn't use weapons.
Who says that?
Oftentimes you hear, it's going to be taken away from you, used against you.
I've never said that.
Well, that's because you're progressive and you're a trainer. But the average individual, the general public says, oh, no, you shouldn't carry a knife, you shouldn't carry guns, most likely it's going to be used against you. What they don't tell you is that officers, no different than women, get their guns taken away from them, they get shot with their own service.
It's all about training.
Thank you. So it's not a gender issue, it has to do with being trained properly. And when I teach, I really stress the importance of weapon retention, you know, really knowing your weapon. And that's why I believe that edge weapons, firearms, are all part, should be part of everybody's training. And if I had it my way, no different than we learned how to read and write, learn how to, you know, do math, you should learn how to take care of yourself. Because if you think about it, especially for women who tend to be more obviously more victimized than men, we invest a lot of time in taking care of everything else, but we don't invest enough time in taking care of our bodies. And when you think of a holistic approach to optimal wellness, that should include being able to take care of this physical body when someone attempts to assault you. And that's something that isn't always encouraged. Women think that, okay, I'm going to go, okay, I went to my women's self-defense seminar, I'm good for the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that could be like 3 more podcasts just to get into that. I'm not even going to go there this time, but... There's a certain mindset like that.
And it's kind of...
Some of it is denial. It's not going to ever happen to me.
I strongly believe that. And the other is when we live in an age that women are strong and powerful and I can take care of myself, taking self-defense classes on... And I this is my own opinion. I believe that on some level it's admitting vulnerability that we don't want to admit because... If I need to learn to defend myself on some level, that's a weakness. So it kind of plays hand in hand with that idea of denying, being in denial. But
well, I think we're just different than the general public. I had my daughter in martial arts. She had a black belt by the time she was 16.
And as mine are right there, too.
How old are your daughters now?
I have a 13-year-old daughter who trains with me, and I have a 16-year-old daughter who also trains and has her black belt. 13-year-old, not yet.
My sister's trained right with me. And we were all teenagers. We're all in the same classes together. We're all at the shooting range together. We were all horseback riding together. We were all doing karate together.
But, that's fantastic.
Awesome. Yeah. In fact, one of my sisters is here today at the seminar with Mass.
Right, she's taking the class.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Now, I also hear that you're working on a new knife design.
Yes, I am. At this time, I'm developing a new design where I'm actually going to have a couple different sizes, mm-hmm. and that should be out sometime this year.
And you're working with who?
I'm working with Bram Frank out of Florida.
Okay.
Who's designed several knives.
Okay. Most of our listeners have probably heard of him.
Yeah, Bram Frank, yes. Mm-hmm. And also, we'll have a book coming out in the very near future, in the next few months, for women, a women's self-defense book that's focusing more on the mental and the psychological aspects of survival. Cool. And lastly, the physical.
Does it have a title yet?
The Lioness Within.
Oh, I like it.
That's a good name.
I like it. We'll be looking for that.
Thank you.
You have a history in the knife world of writing for some of the knife magazines.
Yes. I used to write for Knives. I guess Greg Walker was the editor, and Blade Magazine. Mm-hmm. And since in 1980, when I was introduced to the Filipino martial arts, I became just enamored with that art. And as you know, it's very much a knife culture. Mm-hmm. And but... Even with studying that art, I understood that there's artistic aspect, which I really enjoy. But I started thinking more in terms of what is for street. And for years, I believed that it was important to learn to use a blade only because the chances are greater that you will be assaulted by someone with the blade. And as the years went on, I started thinking and changing the way I thought that why not carry... Folders are readily available. And not just carrying a folder in your purse or someplace you can access it, but also more people get attacked every year with edge weapons than any other weapon. And it's not a fancy knife, but it's, you know, a Phillips screwdriver. Most of us know that, right? So I believe that for that training with a knife takes the fear of the unknown. So people feel more confident if someone comes at them with a knife. They won't freak out because they played with knives. They understand their limitations. They understand their strengths. So I think it's important for people to train with all weapons, whether they choose to ever they're ever going to carry one or not. So just to understand them.
So it eliminates the panic that may come with being shown a knife,
which can be very scary.
A friend of mine, actually, and I've interviewed him on the show, but it was, 3 years ago now. He said, because he used to work at a convenience store at a gas station, and he was robbed at gunpoint, and he was robbed at knife point. And he said he was far more terrified
of the blade, the
knife, than he ever was of the gun. The guy put the gun in his face, was like, here, take the money. Then the guy came around the counter and put the knife to his throat. He was paralyzed.
It's just an intuition, but our feeling of, I've always said I'd rather be shot than stabbed. If I had to be, and I think you always think of the blade in terms of it's very elusive. It's scary. One of the most difficult things weapons to defend against is a blade. It takes, anyone can use a blade. It doesn't take skill to use a knife. Women that don't feel confident and they think, oh, I don't want to use a knife to defend myself. I tell them, if you've ever prepared food, you already know, your body already possesses the physical dexterity to chop, slice and dice. So you already know how to use a knife. It takes very little skill. And an untrained person, when I worked on Tennessee versus Barnes with Mass, in that case where unfortunately the wife got shot, she came at her husband with a blade, and I was brought in to try to educate the jury on why was he justified. An untrained individual with unpredictable patterns of movement is far more dangerous than, I believe, somebody with training, because with training, you become predictable. Mm-hmm. No matter how sloppy you are, a punch is going to come down. You know the trajectory of the weapon. An untrained individual, you have no idea where they're coming from. So, I tell students, people spend a lifetime training to learn how to really defend. The skill is in stopping the knife that's coming at you, not in using a knife. Because if someone has a mindset to hurt you, you could walk up and punch someone. You could pick up a stick and hit someone. If they don't see it coming, you don't need to have a black belt to hurt someone. The skill comes in stopping the attack.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree completely. And one of the things I always like to say in the dojo is the person who's most likely to hurt you is the white belt.
Because that's,
it's
very
fast,
typical,
and furious, and no
form.
And it's just power and speed versus control and training and skill.
My daughter had her arm broken by a white belt.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very common in schools. In any form of martial arts school, everyone knows that. It's the white belt that hurts the black belts, because the black belt has the control and can pull the punch, and the white belt feels, oh, I'm getting one in, he's not hurting me, but not realizing that they're controlling the situation, that they don't want to hurt you. So,
one of the things that you've really brought to light is that your focus on self-defense is complete self-defense. Empty-handed, blades. So let's talk about firearms now. What are your feelings towards firearms?
Well, I believe that firearms, especially firearms training, is part of, as a martial artist who doesn't only focus on the artistic aspect, because people should understand that martial arts offers different things to different people. You have the artistic, you have the competition, and then you have street defense. And I was probably one of the first persons in the early 80s who was writing articles, publishing articles on why martial arts, firearms training should be part of your martial arts trainings. In Black Belt magazines, I've published several articles. And I believe for the same reason, whether you choose to use a firearm, there's very few people, I guess, if you would think, that are going to carry a concealed weapon or have a concealed weapons permit. But the minute you choose to purchase a firearm for home safety, then you should know how to use it no different than you use a blade or any other weapon. So I think it's very important. I think that there's people are terrified of firearms because they think if there's a firearm involved, it's all over. And I don't believe that. I believe that within arm's reach, you do have a chance. And it's not that easy to shoot anyone that shoots. I'm not talking about target practice, standing in front of a silhouette, but in combat shooting, it's not that easy to be accurate to hit a moving target. So I would never be the type of person to think, I don't have a chance, I'm going to go for it. And as Mass teaches, and if you don't survive, at least you take them with you. So I think it's very important. I through all the training that I've had, mostly through MassIU, through the Lethal Force Institute, I developed a new appreciation for using a firearm and the importance of not just learning how to use it for target practice, but using it in a combat situation. And then came, in my life, came children. And then at one point in my life, I just put all my guns away. I said, okay, I have babies in the house. I gave them to a family member. I said, could you keep these for me? In a blink of an eye, 15 years has gone by. Where I would go out to
the range. Now those babies have grown up.
Now those babies are 13 and 16. In the last couple of years, I go, oh, gosh, I need to collect my firearms that are scattered amongst my family. And it was also because my youngest daughter said, Mom, I should learn this. And I looked at her, instead of saying, are you crazy? I said, you're right. We need to teach you.
What was her impetus behind that? What?
I'm.
Why did she ask? If she had them around the house.
She hasn't had them around the house, but in the summers where she goes back east or, to West Virginia, she's around it there where she has seen, her father, has taken her out and had her shoot. So because she trains in the martial arts with me, she also, I get on her own, sees it as, I should learn this also.
So she saw the potential as a self-defense weapon, not just plinking or hunting.
Exactly. Exactly. And says, I need to learn about it. And I realized, okay, I know other people have taught their children much younger. But I just never felt, they never asked about it. And I also was unsure whether they had the maturity to be exposed to it. But once they start asking, you can't keep them from them. You need to lead them to and say, okay, we'll take a class together. We'll learn about it.
Are you teaching them now?
No, this just happened recently.
Oh, okay. This happened.
A few days ago.
Great.
But you have plans.
But I have plans. Masad Ayub said, Alify One. Bring her, we'll go take her training. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm still
old school.
Yeah. Oh, you can scratch that.
That's okay.
Yeah, I can't. That's all I've ever known it as.
So, are you going to bring her?
I'm going to plan to. Well, it was just a conversation earlier, but I definitely plan to. I remember when his daughters were young, he had them shooting, and so. It's sort of it's scary because I believe in the society we live today, and there's such a predator mentality that I have two daughters and I want them to be able to take care of themselves. I understand that when they go out in the world, they go off to university, God willing, I want to be able to rest at night knowing that if they get into some situation, they can first use the weapon of their mind to hopefully control the situation, and if it escalates to a physical level, that they have a chance. So for that reason, I think it's important for them to learn. The question comes up as to when are they ready, and everyone is a different individual, and are they mature enough to handle it? Can you really trust that they understand it's a weapon is always loaded with, and that they're not going to play with it, and it's not so much your child necessarily, but if friends come over or the curiosity, oh, my mom's got guns, where are they? Let's find them. And because I didn't have a proper safe, I also chose to not have them in my home until I could do
that. So now you have to worry about all those things.
All those things, yes.
Getting them to a class and teaching them.
And get safes and locks and all those good things too.
Right.
Well, I think the right time is when they start asking, when they express an interest in it, like with anything else. When they start asking us, is the time.
And I go through many scenarios. Oftentimes, it's my daughters and I home alone at night, and because my husband works out of town. And oftentimes, the scenarios we were learning today in class, I think about that constantly. I hear a sound, and I say, okay, what would I do right now? My daughter's in this room. Will I be able to get to her? What do I have? Is the machete underneath my bed going to be enough? Because I don't have a gun nearby. And all of that, and I role play constantly, and I try to, I talk to them also, but at some point you have to really have a concrete plan and spend the energy with your family to know what to do in any situation.
It's outstanding advice.
You're one of the up-and-coming new star shooters that I see is a 15-year-old girl.
Wow.
And she is kicking butt taking names all over the place. So girls are better than boys? Shooting. Girls are usually better shots.
My sister, than boys. When she practices, is a much better shot than I am.
And that is, do you believe, because we have more of a steady hand? I know with the weapons, I know with the impact, the stick in the Filipino martial arts, one of my instructors with Danny Nosanta, who always encouraged me and said, he would tell me off to the side, not in front of the guys, but hey, stick with the women. Women are better at this than men. And one of his instructors, Flora Villabrill, who was in years ago, was one of the grandmasters in Kauai, told me a story about how he learned from a woman. So, and I've always heard that women have more the dexterity, the flexibility, you know. So for women, put a stick, put a knife, put a gun in their hand, she has an equalizer.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay, I think that does it. I really appreciate your time.
No problem.
Sharing your experiences with us. I think it's going to help both of the audiences of Practical Defense and Pro Arms a lot.
I hope it's good. I'm a little rough. I haven't done interviews in years.
You did great.
Thank you.
When every moment matters and a life is saved, when someone gives blood, when a hand reaches out, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Down the street, across the country, around the world, you help save the day. Every day. Your support truly matters. You can help today. Visit redcross.org.
Welcome back. Again, I would like to thank Graciela and Gail for the awesome interview. They are both wonderful people. And that will do it for this week. You can follow my daily tips on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, I'm Practical Def, and on Facebook, it's Practical Defense. If you have any tips you would like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexaddix.com. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe. Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense Podcast. For questions, commentary, and topic suggestions, send an email to podcast@alexaddix.com. That's podcast@alexaddix.com. And if you ever want to train with me, look me up on the web at alexaddix.com.